So I wanted to, you know, get more involved with the writing community in New York outside of just comedy.
It's like a really perfect screenplay. It's like
Hollywood
has budget. Let a real comedy writer have a pass at the comedy.
Action,
stuff.
Coming-of-age genre, Ben, sometimes from the 80s, sometimes referred to as the go-for-it genre.
The only thing that we want to talk about is the craft here, that so we can improve our own work.
Welcome to The Script. This is the monthly podcast of the NYC Screenwriters Collective. I'm your host, David Negrin. This is our first podcast, so let's get it going. First up, we have our Script Doctor review of Argo by Chris Terrio, March 2010 draft. It's going to be reviewed by our NYC Screenwriters Script Doctors, Chris Theokas, David Negrin, and Mike DeLuca.
Action of Iran have shocked the civilized world.
Let's go,
Strength
everything.
Our embassy has been seized and more than 60 American citizens continue to be held as hostages.
If we're going to go, then we need to go now.
I'm here with my co-host, Chris Theokas.
And I'm here with my host, David Negrin.
Welcome. It's our first podcast of The Script from the NYC Screenwriters Collective. We're going to talk about Argo today.
So we have been going back and forth on whether it's a spy thriller or what was it?
Someone said political thriller.
A political thriller.
I don't agree.
And it's
somebody said it was a comedy also.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. It's based on the 1980 exfiltration of 6 Americans from the Canadian embassy in Iran. By a CIA exfiltration expert, Tony Mendez.
I'm so glad you said exfiltration. I just want to talk about that.
You want to talk about exfiltration?
Yeah, I do.
And it was directed by Ben Affleck, written by, like you said, Chris Terrio. We are going to be reviewing the March 25th, 2010 draft.
Are you sure we're not reviewing the original science fiction film version draft of
Argo? That would actually be pretty cool. I was thinking that while I was reading it, like, why don't they make this movie now?
I Googled it a little. It is like a Star Wars ripoff. And there are robots in it that are like R2-D2 and C-3PO. I think there's a Lando Calrissian too.
I imagine there is.
Yeah.
Then that would have been before Lando was introduced to the world, I think.
Oh, right.
But anyway, we are reviewing that for our first podcast.
Yeah. Do you want to go first? Do you want to tell us...
Well, what I liked about the script was, and the story in general, is if it is a spy thriller, if that's the classification, it does go against the typical trend of Jason Bourne and James Bond, those thrillers where there's a lot of action, there's gunfights and so on. The main character knows many forms of, say, martial arts, and they always get the very attractive woman. Right.
Because we don't have special effects yet.
We can get special effects. They're free on the internet. Trust me.
Okay.
Anyway, I really like that. I like the Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy vibe to it, where it's just, this is what's really happening. This is what truly happened. The other things I liked about it were the inclusion of clips from the news.
That was me.
Yeah. I'm eyes on you, Negrin. I really like the inclusion.
I'm getting
of the,
hate mail already. That's
already, I mean. Yeah. The inclusion. I really like the inclusion of news clips from the time period. They were out of order, but in the script itself, they were marked. There would be an asterisk next to the dialogue, and then in the action lines below, it would say when and where it was from. There seemed to be a pretty decent emotional arc for the Tony Mendez character. At least I thought there was, and it was fairly clear
what
why.
What was his arc? What did he...
Well, I think it was tied to his son, because it opens. It doesn't open when he heads out at the midpoint to go to Iran to actually do the job. He sends the postcard to his son, the happy birthday postcard. I'm sorry, I can't be there. I love you both so much. And throughout the movie, especially up to that point, he's trying to connect with his son. He wants to be there for him. He wants his family back. And basically, at the midpoint, he's basically saying, I can't be there for you. I have to go. And I have to do this thing that I can't tell you about.
Is it because he's not around a lot, and they're divorced, and the dad's not there?
Basically, because when you get into the very... Right before you get into the break into three, he's being told the operation's over, burn the passports, you know, you're going to leave the country, and these people are going to either be taken, you know, hostage or die. And he has to make a decision. Do I abandon these people and go back to the U.S. and, you know, or do I step up and be there for them the way I couldn't be with my son?
So
that's what I took
away
from.
That's a metaphor? It's for a metaphor for not being a deadbeat dad?
I think so, essentially.
Not being a deadbeat right? CIA agent.
And so then when he goes back at the very end in the coda, he basically goes to see his family and he gets his family back. Mm. And, of course, with the title cards at the end or the text cards at the end basically saying he couldn't tell anybody about it until, like, I think it was the late 90s. What I would have found interesting is, you know, maybe telling the story after the fact. Like, what was happening between him and his son? Like, you were never there.
Did he tell the kid?
No, that's the thing. That was a weakness, I think.
Right?
Was he never tells the
kid.
That's
one of those things, those moments, like, you know, that you want in the story.
Hey, David, what did you like about Argo?
Okay, so this was a competently written story, okay? And it's actually really lighthearted for the first half. And I kind of like that part. I kind of like the idea of the bumbling Hollywood comedy about, oh, we've got to make a.
Let's put on a show.
Let's put on a show. It was a very kind of almost David Mamet-esque, like State and Maine making fun of the business.
Right.
And it was funny, and you know they're doing casting calls and they're interviewing writers, and the guy is saying if I'm going to make a fake movie, it's going to be the best fake movie.
I remember feeling like they're poking fun at it, but it's an affectionate poke.
That's an interesting movie.
Yeah.
Okay? Problem is, that's not what this movie starts as. The first act, again, builds this as a political / spy thriller. And then we get into the first half of the second act, and it's just like tonally completely different. It's a big problem for me, right? I mean, before I jump into that, I thought also the second half as a spy thriller was competent and it was interesting. It was like, it was definitely like Tinker Tailor or Spy Who Came In From the Cold. It's not your action spy thriller like Bourne or James
right.
Bond, but it's more thoughtful. Reminded me a little bit of Spy Game, one of my very favorites.
Right.
Affleck is a competent director. He's shown great, that he doesn't overreach. He's not trying to do, like, big epic movies. He's trying to tell little stories with good characters in them, and he's getting it done. And I guess he stars in it for the star power. Good job there. I have no problem watching Affleck. He's funny. He's a funny guy. In fact, it works for the comedy. That lighthearted stuff, Ben Affleck's talent is really... You know, he's a funny guy.
Yeah, the Stranger in a Strange Land, fish out of water vibe to it a bit.
Sure, sure. But, you know, my big trouble with Argo is that this movie ends up feeling small for several reasons. The story opens with hostages being taken by extremists. And instead of following the story of the extremists and the hostages, we end up following the story of six guys who got out the back door.
Right, and it's almost a chamber piece at that point.
Right, it's like you're setting up this huge thing, and then the bigger story is like, okay, we're going to not talk about that. And then you cut to like 2 months later where you know, there's apparently a huge hostage crisis, but we're worried about these six who are like drinking wine and
hanging out.
How do we get home? It made the movie feel small from the outset,
yeah. It confined all the action into one spot,
yeah,
pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, and I understand, but you just have to open it differently. You have to open... and also in a spy thriller, you're supposed to open with our special agent, our guy doing what he's good at.
Right.
We should have opened with him exfiltrating somebody from a small country, a small crisis... You know, and if he pulls a few people out of another country, you know, in a small way, very simple way, not like a big epic problem, then when the hostage crisis in Iran, in the Tehran embassy comes, we think, oh, well, this is a big version of this.
So how does the March 25th, 2010 draft open, if you remember?
I don't remember.
It actually opens like that. He's in Russia, which is big, relatively speaking. And he's trying to exfiltrate somebody into Finland,
right.
And the exfiltration goes bad. And the person that he's exfiltrating dies. not because he screwed up, but because the guy was crazy.
Yeah.
Now, that said, when I was reading it, I felt like, while it was exciting, it felt like part of a different movie. And I can kind of understand why they cut it.
Okay, but see, this is what I'm saying, is like the part of that, the part that makes it feel like a different movie is the first half of the second act, where they're making the movie.
Right.
Where they're in Hollywood, when they're doing all this business of you know, like casting calls and scripts analysis and talking about sci-fi, it just gets really silly, you know? We see all these guys with silly, like, science fiction outfits, and they're on set of a sci-fi movie. You know what that does? That cuts the tension out of a thriller. Okay, a thriller is supposed to have tension throughout
building.
It's supposed
to be tight.
It cuts the tension out of the thriller, and it completely makes me believe there's no way anybody important is going to die in this movie. You know why? Because we're treating it lightly. All right, so in summary... You first and then me.
Oh, fine. Drop it in my lap. I thought it was, like you said, competently written. It was a fine thriller that certainly needed some punching up in terms of the stakes. It had a clear emotional arc for the Tony Mendez character. I think he grew to learn something. Hopefully it happened in real life.
I think that this movie is a great, you know... a simple spy thriller, if we can cut out one quarter of it, the whole Hollywood business. I think it fell a little bit prey to the, oh, we've got to tell the whole true story business. You know, instead of, it let the little T truth get in the way of
the big T truth,
like, that they're trying to tell. And you know, you got to take poetic license. Somebody got really enamored with the sci-fi movie Hollywood side of this, and it interrupted what could have been a really solid spy thriller. Also, I think it took a lot of the juice out of it. So, I don't know. Entertaining movie.
I think if you cut out about 15 or 20 minutes, you'd still have a 90-minute film, yeah.
Yeah. It is 2 hours. The film, I believe, is 2 hours, so... Let's get to Tehran, and let's have some more spycraft stuff and more exfiltrations.
And shoot somebody in the thigh.
Okay. On that note.
Have you gotten people out this way before?
No. You're asking us to trust you with our lives. This is what I do, and I've never left anyone behind.
They know who they are, and they know they're hiding out.
It's over, Tony.
If they stay here, they will be taken.
Probably not alive.
We're responsible for these people. I'm responsible.
Right, so now I'm sitting with Mike DeLuca, who's another one of our script doctors, and who's also our tracking board czar. I want to talk to him about Argo. We've got quite a few opinions so far, but what was your read on that?
Oh God, it's Alan Arkin and Ben Affleck was robbed for the Oscar. It's depressing. It's depressing. The Academy has no brain. It has no anima. I can't believe it. Go see Stand Up Guys while you can.
Poor Ben. Yeah, I have a lot. Yeah, I have a lot. I mean, I'm somebody who thinks Ben is laughing his way all the way to the Oscars here. I'm sure he didn't mean for this thing to take on all this buzz, but.
Well, I think what's interesting is in the group we studied the 2010 draft, which has a lot more autobiographical stuff about Tony Mendez's backstory, and I think cutting it out makes the film stronger. I mean, I think that we don't need it. We can tell a lot from his relationship with his son, and also. How he handles himself in a situation, a high-pressure situation. Granted, we've got that cliched moment where Ben Affleck's sitting there with the whiskey bottle and he's having that serious Mel Gibson, leave the weapon, should I shoot myself in the head sort of moment, but which we all know how it's going to play out, so there's no real drama there. But at the same time, you know, it basically has a big sign that says, hey, low point, but...
Yeah, but also, yeah, I mean, that's, to me, my whole problem was that the stakes were sabotaged by this little comedy, like, first half of the second act, where all the Hollywood business, You know, it took out all the stakes for me, and nobody really dies at a low point. In a thriller, somebody's supposed to freaking die. I think somebody got shot, but it was nobody we knew. And I don't know what the draft, I wanted this to be a spy thriller, right? And it was like some genre bend between a Hollywood send up and a spy thriller light. And the opening of the script opens with a mission. You know, that's what you're supposed to do in a spy thriller. James Bond is on another mission doing cool stuff, and we see that he's awesome. But we don't know Tony Mendez. We don't know that he's awesome. And in this movie, he just sort of shows up at a meeting and criticizes their bicycle plan, which, I don't know, sound pretty good to me.
Well, I think the bicycle plan would have tanked on day one, but
I don't know about that. I mean, like, there's a lot of more people cycling these days, especially the streets in New York City. People are really, they have more endurance. I thought it could have gone somewhere, and but we don't know that he's an exfil specialist. He's into exfiltration. I'm still not sure what that is.
Well, the heightened eco-consciousness of the New York City metropolitan population aside, I think that his competence is shown in his demeanor, how he handles himself in the situation. And I think that the fact that he's willing to come up with this crazy plan, he's kind of like, what is that line in Joe Carnahan's ill-fated remake of The A-Team? It's these guys specialize in the ridiculous, and that's kind of what he does. And I think that he thinks outside of the box, which suggests that this isn't your average run-of-the-mill CIA guy who's going to sit in a corner out behind the Iron Curtain and smoke cigarettes dramatically.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be cool to see him do a mission before this? You know, open with a mission, not a mission to save, like, a murderer, it turns out, but, like, a mission to save somebody. Maybe it goes wrong. Maybe it goes wrong and that's where his arc is. He screws up. He loses a guy, and he's not going to lose these diplomats the way he lost it in the first act.
I guess the problem with that is taking the time to know your audience, because one of the things that's not in the draft that was reviewed by the group is the prologue that opens the film, which lays the backstory of the installation of the Shah by American corporate interests, the removal of the Shah, and the placing of Ayatollah Khomeini in power, and the United States' refusal to send the Shah back to Iran to be tried for crimes.
How did you feel about that opening documentary?
I thought it was pretty good. I mean, it's only condescending if you know the facts. But the fact is, let's face it, without sounding condescending about American audiences, a lot of people aren't familiar with the story, you know, and it's a chapter in history that's been pushed under the rug, probably by a lot of, dare I say, not to get all political here, but Ronald Reagan hype.
Yeah.
You know, Ronald Reagan, first day in office, you know, hostages are released. That doesn't sound suspicious at all, but hey, you know. So.
But, you know, it reminded me of the opening of The Kingdom, right?
Yeah.
You remember that, where they have the montage talking about Saudi Arabia, oil interests and stuff like that? If you're going to have a political thriller,
yeah,
you do have to introduce the audience to the political the context. But this is not a political thriller. None of this plays in ever, because first things first, we open with a movie about the Iran hostage crisis and the background of the Iran hostage crisis, and we see President Carter and we think about all these stakes, and then this story is about the six people who didn't get taken hostage. It's like the other one's a much more interesting story and needs the context and needs the opening. If you wanted to stick with just this little spy thriller about this little exfiltration, you should have just stuck with it. And, you know, in the background, let the Iran in the background. I don't know. I was just dissatisfied with the stakes of this whole movie, and taking that little comedy tour down into Hollywood removed the stakes even more for me. So.
Well, I think that by providing the backdrop, it provides the stakes, because you can die at any moment. And there's also
you thought people could die at any moment?
Yeah, because, I mean, there's we're talking about a small group of people holed up in the Canadian embassy. And the fact is that everyone else ended up getting rounded up. I mean, there's that terrifying moment when the protesters bust into the building, the American embassy in Iran. And you have this dramatic moment where there's this office worker this woman who's got these glasses, and just in a simple, rather terrifying gesture, this protester comes over and just rips her glasses off her face.
That was a wonderful moment, like a film, yeah, because it was like a violation.
Yeah,
you know, it's not like he ripped her clothes off or anything; just took her glasses off. That was well done.
Yes.
But still, after the initial crowd, like, rushing the embassy and taking the hostages, the subject of our movie is these six people at the Canadian embassy. I never felt they were in danger. We had that one series where the maid starts to realize something's going to happen, that maybe they're not Canadians, but then it never pays off, really. I didn't feel, I wanted more stakes, and that's why you kill someone in a thriller. That's why someone's supposed to die at the low point of a thriller, because it reminds you, yeah, something in the third act, somebody else could die, somebody even more important. But I don't know.
Well, two things. One, it's the Soderbergh question. Process. What's more interesting? Thriller stakes or the actual process of things being carried out? I mean, every Soderbergh movie is essentially about process. Process, yeah. Of revolution in Che. Even Ocean's 11, it's the process of busting into a casino and taking the loot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what's interesting for me about Argo is that they put this ridiculous plan into motion that shouldn't work, capitalizing on the success of Star Wars, of all things.
Yes.
And to me, that was the hook of the story. And all but the, whereas the political overtones, frankly, manifest themselves at the very end of the film when we hear the voice of President Carter, and then we realize that the story is about the American operation being vindicated, because for years it didn't get the credit, and the Canadians got the credit, the Canadian ambassador, and rightfully so, but at the same time, there was another group of people at play, busting their ass and running down corridors with pushing papers and sending communications back and forth, but at the same time, also out in the field with Tony Mendez. And also it says something about the bravery of the hostages that they're willing to go through with this crazy harebrained scheme that shouldn't work. And to me, it vindicates Carter, who could have used this information, this classified information, to basically get himself reelected and say, hey, I'm doing something about the hostage crisis. But it says volumes about his character that he didn't. And I think that revelation is fascinating unto itself.
Next up is our tracking board preview with Mike DeLuca.
It should be noted that I'm delivering this report on behalf of the collective, and this is not a venture on behalf of the tracking board. It just happens to be the source of this news. So, dear readers, the obvious question is, where have I been for the last month and a half? Where did I go for the holidays? The short version. I was institutionalized, coupled with heavy sedation. The long version? There I was in Trader Vic's, seated, nursing a pina colada, recuperating from a toxing all-night sex session with Dame Judi Dench and Betty White. Lovely girls. It was then Alan Arkin approached me and, mistaking me for an Academy voter, proceeded to perform a lap dance on my person. Oh God, oh God! His drooping flesh pressed its way into the cracks and crevices of my body, leaving not an inch untouched. Finally, he finished saying, thanks for the vote, big boy, followed by, I'm going to be late for the dentist, oh God, oh God! Stumbling out into daylight, I was dry-humped in an alley by Gilbert Gottfried. Since then, all my dreams have been plagued by faceless phantoms, all with the voice of Iago from Aladdin. And all that led to my little therapeutic vacation and the return of this report. Plus, it was either that or going to see Hansel and Gretel Witch Hunters, and frankly, I value life. So, without further ado, we start with a scoop on some of the big script sales and specs of the last month that have hit the town, and by that I mean sold. Now, it should be noted that this February marks the release of the latest in the Die Hard franchise, and it's interesting that you've got next year two projects, too, one directed by Roland Emmerich, that feature the plot of the White House being under siege, which is basically a diehard staple. I mean, it's interesting that outside of, say, Air Force One, that during the 90s, during that diehard ripoff era of Under Siege and Speed, that nobody thought to say, hey, let's have somebody bust into the White House and hold the president hostage and have the president fight back. So that's one of the new trends. I think the action spec's going to be back in a big way, so check that out. Let's see, what else do we have here? Ben-Hur by Keith Clark. Yes, somebody's actually remaking Ben-Hur. Story will tell, formative story of Judah Ben-Hur, blah, blah, blah. You know the rest. Ben-Hur rises to power, parallels his story with Jesus Christ, and has his buddy Marcella, played by Stephen Boyd and whatnot, you know. And I seriously, I mean, can anybody top Charlton Heston and I thought so, Gore Vidal? Don't answer that question. It should be noted that it was featured prominently in the documentary The Celluloid Closet about the intentional overtones placed by Gore Vidal within the film between the Charlton Heston and Stephen Boyd characters. So the next time you watch Ben-Hur over the holidays, think of that, and it'll add something to the experience. Also, speaking of Roland Emmerich and his whole wheelhouse, we've got an untitled project from Dean Devlin and Paul Goyet. Dean Devlin, as you might have already known, has been Roland Emmerich's sideman for years during the Godzilla, Stargate, and even The Patriot. I mean,
Independence Day.
They got together, actually, back when he did a movie called Moon 44, where Dean Devlin actually acted in alongside Master Thespian Michael Paré of Eddie and the Cruisers fame, and Malcolm McDowell. And slowly but surely, he just got absorbed into the process, and they became buddies. And this is about a global disaster, and which I imagine shall devastate the globe. So there it is, from Skydance Productions. We have The Residence from Joe Ballarini. A tour guide discovers the White House again, is haunted and must stop an evil curse from inflicting the First Family. Suddenly I have this image of Bill Clinton stalking the hallways like a spectral force with a saxophone like he did back on Arsenio Hall. Say, Barry, we need a... you, Michelle, I think a three-way would be excellent today. And, Bill, don't make me call your wife. I have her number, you know. I gotta go.
Ooh!
So the writer is represented by Paradigm and Apostle Pictures. And Jerry Bruckheimer is producing, so you know it's going to get made. And probably a lot of flashy edits. So in short, that was only a meager amount of spec scripts sold in the last month or so. And I think that it shows you a lot. At the beginning of the year, things are slow, and it's just like the same odds of finding a good movie to watch in the theater. Very, very low. Very low chances. And now a bit of casting news. Bill Hader of SNL fame will take up David Hasselhoff's Speedo in Reno 911 writer Robert Ben-Gurion's film version of Baywatch. Hader versus Hasselhoff? Hader couldn't survive Baywatch nights. He couldn't bring down the Berlin Wall single-handedly while singing songs of freedom. No, that's Hasselhoff. He's a funny guy, but does he know SpongeBob SquarePants on a personal basis? I don't think so. Moving on.
Will we get a cameo?
Maybe that. I mean, the Hoff's going to show up.
It's got to.
Maybe eating a burger. I don't know. But
maybe inebriated on a car somewhere.
Maybe inebriated driving Kit. You know, Michael. We've got. But also, we've got Ray Liotta and Muppets 2. And here's my thought. I think him and Miss Piggy are going to get it on. I think it's inevitable, really. And I think Kermit, previously having plotted his revenge against Mitt Romney for suggesting cutting the children's television workshop, is going to team up with probably Charles Grodin, still smarting from The Great Muppet Caper, and they're going to get together and they're going to go after Ray Liotta, who, by all accounts, is a bad fellow. So,
where are we going to get the scene where the Muppets are all doing blow at a casino? That's the question.
Yeah, I don't know. Seeing the helicopters and whatnot. Yeah, some George Harrison.
Whole another Muppet Caper.
Yeah, yeah. Martin Scorsese is a Muppet. Not a stretch. Also, the talk of the town this week, this month actually, sorry. We've got a script called Orbit by Bruce Guido. A team of astronauts orbiting the Earth find they may be the only world's hope during a devastating alien attack. It's contained. It's science fiction. It's got an extraterrestrial invasion. Somewhere in executives like, oh my God, this is better than sex. So, because that's what's going on today. And honestly, the writing's meat and potatoes. It evokes the claustrophobia of being in the space station very well. And Ben Affleck is not going to arrive with Bruce Willis. And it definitely has a bleak, doomsaying sort of tone. So I'm thinking that Affleck wouldn't have been robbed if Alan Arkin's lap dancing skills were better. But that's just my opinion. Oh God, Academy, why am I not good for you anymore?
I need that young stuff.
I need that young stuff. You know,
Walken's beating me. Christopher Walken, what are you talking about? I could have been Superman, Fortress of Solitude. Wow. More cowboy. So, the script's in everywhere, basically. And, yeah. So, if you have a chance to look at the trailer for a movie called This Is the End, with James Franco, Seth Rogen, Danny McBride, Jonah Hill, Craig Robinson, and briefly from what I hear, Michael Cera. It's basically a bunch of young actors playing themselves and facing the apocalypse. Self-indulgent, narcissistic, self-parodying. I don't know, but check it out. It's pretty cool. So, until next time, this is your Tracking Board Czar Mike signing off, saying I'll see you at Swizz and buy me a pint or a barrel. Bring a flask. I'll see you there. Trackingboard.com, you can read my column On the Slate with Mike DeLuca. If you want to hear dirty jokes, off-color humor, Hollywood taken by storm in 1,000 words, then check it out. You'll dig it.
And last, our Oscar roundup with David Negrin, Chris Theokas, and Patrick Penta. Okay, so with the Oscar season coming up and our podcast being about screenwriting, we're gonna talk about the Oscar nominations for Best Original Screenplay and Best Adapted Screenplay. I've got with me Chris Theokas and Patrick Penta, and both experts in the field, both men of interesting hairstyles.
That's right.
Definitely.
Okay. So I'm just going to quickly list off the Oscar nominations for Original Screenplay. Amour by Michael Haneke, Django Unchained by Quentin Tarantino, Flight by John Gittins, Moonrise Kingdom by Wes Anderson and Roman Coppola, and Zero Dark Thirty by Mark Boal. Best Adapted Screenplay is Argo, written by Chris Terrio, Beast of the Southern Wild by Lucy Alibar and Ben Zeitlin, Life of Pi by David McGee, Lincoln by Tony Kushner, and Silver Linings Playbook by David O. Russell. So with that, Chris, how do you feel about the Oscar nominations and any of these screenplays out in the film zeitgeist?
Well, you already know how I feel about Argo.
Yes.
But in terms of the adapted screenplays...
Why is Argo adapted?
It's from a magazine article, if I'm not mistaken.
Like the New York Times, like...
I want to say something like that, or The Atlantic. I care.
Okay.
It was adapted. Maybe even from the original files. I don't know.
You could have adapted it from like the Wikipedia history file.
I don't know if that counts. Okay. But in terms of the best adapted screenplay, it's a decent list. You have some, I think you have some very good movies on here. Silver Linings Playbook, Lincoln, Life of Pi, and Beasts of the Southern Wild, which I think is the big surprise just of the year. The fact that I think it got any Oscars whatsoever is a surprise. And in fact, I think that's the one that's going to win.
Really? Where did Beasts come from? What is it adapted from?
So it's adapted from, my understanding, a one-woman play by Lucy Alibar. And it's, I want to say she did it down in Louisiana, if not New Orleans itself. Where they shot it, it was a collective shoot, apparently. They wrote the script and they allowed the actors, from my understanding, they allowed the actors to kind of improv some of their scenes and so on.
So, as a writing achievement, that's what we're supposed to be rating, you know, an Oscar is supposed to be a writing achievement.
It's one of those things where
about the directing or the acting.
It's one of those things where it's their first Oscar nod for what's, you know, a very impressive movie. I think it's going to be a win for them because it's going to say, hey, we really appreciate you as filmmakers, please continue to do this. Like Quentin Tarantino won it for Pulp Fiction. It was kind of like, well, you'd made a good movie, but we're not going to give you Best Picture.
Yeah.
And that's what I think it is. It's just an encouragement on that part.
Sure.
What should win? I would say probably either Lincoln or Silver Linings Playbook.
Because of hype?
Yeah.
Probably because of hype, but probably also they might actually just be better written scripts.
Well, I know that the first draft of Tony Kushner's Lincoln was adapted from Doris Kearns Goodwin's A Team of Rivals.
Right.
And he, as a writer, his first crack at it was to adapt the entire book, and it was a 5-hour-long script, a 500-page script, because it was a book written by a historian. Facts, bunch of facts.
Right.
You know? And then they had to cut it down into the movie that we saw, which was, unfortunately, facts. With a couple really interesting moments. I think it was a... Tony Kushner's one of my favorite writers, period. Angels in America, Carolina Change. I'm a huge fan of his work. But, you know, he had this unfortunate challenge of dramatizing how a bill becomes a law.
Well, that's the thing. It's like if you think of most political films or anything about Lincoln himself, and this is why I think it's probably a better film to maybe award based on those kind of merits, is because we're not getting a Lincoln who is, you know, an icon. We're getting Lincoln as he had to actually do this to pass this thing. And that's the only reason I'm saying. I'm not saying that it's probably the best thing ever written by Tony Kushner or ever, but compared to the other stuff on the list.
Well, I was saying that it's an achievement in adaptation, you know, in taking a huge historic book that has basically only facts in it and creating some drama out of it about, you know, a historical figure is an achievement. I think, I don't know.
Well, who would you pick out of adapted screenplay? Who should win, and who do you think will win, and who should win?
I'm gonna go with Silver Linings Playbook.
I am too. I'm gonna go with Silver Linings Playbook. Yeah. I think it had really beguiling performances, and that may blur. You know how it is. It can blur it where you think, well, maybe I liked the actors, and maybe the script wasn't all that. But I think it did have a great script. And,
what was great? What was?
I really liked the way they took a page from the dark comedy script.
Oh heck yeah!
And which is very difficult to do because you're gonna draw a little blood when you do that, but they did it but they kept it funny.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought the characters were really well drawn. Small, tight cast. What a small group they wrote. Yeah. You know, they had.
To me, Silver Linings Playbook, the achievement was one of these great, and it's all, this comes from the writing, when you dare to push the edge of something, you dare to make jokes about mental illness.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then, when the first couple of jokes you hear about being bipolar or being institutionalized or being on medication, at first you're like, am I allowed to laugh at that? But then they slowly pull you into that world. And all of a sudden you realize, yes, you are allowed to laugh at that because this is these people's lives and they laugh at it. It's the only way to get through it. And that's why it's so affirming. I'm pretty sure the Silver Linings Playbook, the screenplay film ending, felt like it was directed. I don't know that I'm pretty sure the novel didn't turn out that way. Not having read the novel, my feeling is David O. Russell went for this happy ending. And I know it has a little bit to do with the fact that he took on this movie because his son is bipolar, and it meant a lot to him to do a film about that subject. And you could feel David O. Russell is not a sentimental guy. His movies are not sentimental. And then our ending of Silver Linings Playbook is pretty mushy and sentimental. And I felt like he was just like telling his boy, like, everything's going to be okay. See, because my movie is okay.
Yeah, yeah.
As long as you can do the lift, and we have our Dirty Dancing ending.
Yeah, it was... I have to agree with you, although I think it was pretty well earned. They had the couple go out there and do their incredibly crappy dance, and all they had to get was a really mediocre score, and that was the victory enough. So,
Patrick, did you get in your vote for adapted screenplay? You went with Silver Linings Playbook. Any other comments before we move on to original?
I went with Silver Linings Playbook. I know you guys have probably talked Argo into a fine powder.
Sure.
So you don't want to talk about Argo anymore.
No, go for it.
Since he didn't get the nomination for Best Director, you think it's possible they might throw this one at him and saying, hey, not so fast. You're not getting Best. You're not getting Best Director, but we'll give you...
But it's not Affleck. It's Mr. Chris Terrio. You know, it's another guy.
And the script is no way that could... If that won, that would be...
If it's another repeat of the Oscars from the year 2000 when you had Traffic and Gladiator and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And they
wasn't
each
Requiem for a Dream that year too?
Best director is a consolation prize. Best screenplay usually goes to somebody who wrote a great script. I don't think screenplay, either adapt or original, is a consolation. Unless in the certain scenarios, like you were saying, like Chris was saying about Tarantino, where he wrote and directed, you know, a film, then you could, it's a secondary sort of consolation.
Yeah.
The Silver Linings Playbook, I think, was earned. It was the most earned, and that's why they should get it.
Yeah.
Now, moving on.
Best original screenplay.
Best original screenplay. Yep. Okay, we've got Amour, which is the Dark Horse, Django Unchained, Flight, Moonrise Kingdom, and Zero Dark 30. Patrick, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that's a tough list. I seriously doubt. I think the last place on there is Moonrise Kingdom. There's no way.
Oh, my God. Are you serious?
Yeah, I don't think there's any way he's going to get best screenplay.
Are you talking about the best writing, or are you talking about who's going to win?
No, I'm saying he is not going. There's no way.
I don't care who's going to win. Yeah. We're talking about original screenplay. This is, if there's any category that we as screenwriters and this podcast and NYC Screenwriters Collective, that we should be talking about who did the best writing. It's this category. Mm. And you think Wes Anderson did the worst?
I think, well, listen.
It's the most original voice on here.
Well, listen.
I would totally disagree with that, but go ahead.
I mean, Tarantino's on.
But Rushmore was the steak that he served. And he's been serving the same fossilized steak in one form or another. And they've gone steadily into, I think, an abstruse area.
Yes, like, but Moonrise Kingdom was the comeback. I will agree with the different steaks turning into like
fossilized
ham and some salami and right. some spam. But Moonrise Kingdom, we're back to steak. We're back.
Ah, you think?
I believe this was class. This is classic Wes, but finally under control. It was a nice tight movie, original. I thought this is the best Wes Anderson's best writing since Rushmore.
Hmm.
Yeah. One note, Mr. Anderson, I love all your movies, and I think you're absolutely amazing, and I'd love to work with you.
But who's your call? Your call for best? Who did the best work here? The best part.
I defer to you guys. I have to think it's either Amour or. I don't know. I don't know.
Patrick is.
Yeah, I'm drawing
speechless.
A blank here. I'm speechless. Listen, that's it. My Moonrise Kingdom rant. I'm out. I have nothing for you.
You were just anti Moonrise.
That's
okay.
All. Yeah.
Christopher.
All right. I don't honestly know who will win this one because, it feels like a really very mixed bag.
Mixed bag.
I guess you would say Tarantino is going to win it because Django Unchained won the Golden Globe. I don't think that one should win. I loved the movie. The script, I think, just had a big logical flaw in the middle of it.
Was there something that wasn't in the movie that was in the script that was a logical flaw?
No. There's something in the movie that's a logical flaw that's also in the script. Why didn't they just go by her?
Can you simply... Okay. Why didn't
because
they buy
ultimately
her?
That's what they do.
Yes.
All right.
And he had the cash on him.
Yeah. And I wanted the gunfight at the end that we got. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to get there in a different way. That's all. Okay. Otherwise, I think it's a great movie. Flight, I think it was a very competent film. I saw it with somebody who knows people in Al-Anon, and she said that it's a great depiction of alcoholics and addicts. Zero Dark
that
30.
That was a very powerful script. That movie was very... Flight was written extremely well. It is about a slow, like, decomposition. This is sometimes called the deconstruction plot. You know, it's about a man going downhill constantly. That moment.
Do you remember what you said about the tension in Argo?
Yeah.
I kind of had the same issue in Flight.
Okay.
Because I knew where his journey and where it was going to end. And because maybe...
You knew where the movie was going to end.
Yeah, essentially. I mean, it's a redemption story for an alcoholic. It's going to end there. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying that the tension that you're describing, I don't think was there. I thought
he was going to get off. I didn't think he was going to...
When they started throwing the flight attendant under the bus, he wasn't going to do it.
I don't know, man. I bought it. I bought Hook, Line, and Sinner. I thought he was going to get in his plane.
I have some great Florida real estate for you as well.
Okay.
Yeah. To Robert Zemeckis, I really loved Flight, and I would love to... I don't think Zero Dark 30 is going to win simply because of the controversy around it. I think it's on there just as like a consolation to say we think he did
There's
a great
controversy
job.
Controversy about how Mark Bull, as a screenwriter,
it's
decided
one of,
to feature the torture in his film and maybe overemphasize its importance.
It's one of those things where I feel like if it had been any other story, he could have gotten away with it. But this is an incredibly important story to American history that you want to get this one right.
Just right. Can I make a comment on this?
Not yet.
I'm extremely, extremely jealous of Mark Bull. I think he's a great writer and he gets great projects and I want to write those projects.
Certainly, and I think...
That being said, I think there's a little bit of Emperor Has No Clothes here with he and his illustrious director. And I think, yes, this was a very important story where it's important to tell as close to possible what really happened. And I think the controversy about the torture could have been very easily avoided. I've seen interviews with Mark and Catherine Bigelow where people over and over, they keep saying, well, why did you open the movie with torture? Why did you open your movie with torture? And, you know, in screenwriting, we know the opening image is a very important, powerful thing, right? And each time they're asked this question, they're saying, we didn't. They say, we didn't open the movie with torture.
The editor did?
No. Oh. We opened it with the sounds of 9/11. Remember the recording of people calling 911 9/11?
Right, but if...
But what is the operative word in open image? Open
image.
Image. And what do people keep remembering? They keep remembering the first thing we see. Because why? Because this is cinema. It's a cinematic language, okay? Had they shown 9/11 footage... Had they had the balls to do that, in what other movie could you have had the gravitas to actually get away with that? Besides one like this, show some footage. Maybe show us some footage we haven't seen. Something even worse, instead of just the sounds. Then we go to torture, and we think we think oh maybe torture is justified, you know. And this is, I don't know if that was a directing error or writing error, but it is certainly a storytelling error, and it could have avoided all this controversy.
So the one I think, and I actually want to win, is Amour. I like Michael Haneke as a filmmaker and a writer. In the case of Amour, he tells a love story that's unsentimental. Mm. It doesn't pull a single punch, which is what he's good at. And
what has he done?
He did Funny Games twice. That's a home invasion movie, and those scare the shit out of me.
Wow.
He did Cachet, he did The Piano Teacher. They're all very cold, visually cold films. Mm-hmm. Like I said, he doesn't pull punches. I don't necessarily want to say he's topical. Cachet was about, you know, France and Algeria and the relationship between the two countries told between these two characters, but he's an incredible filmmaker. And Amour is his most accessible film and his most accessible script, but that's relative to his previous work. But the reason I like Amour so much is it's kind of an antidote to, like, The Notebook and all of these romantic comedies or even just romance films.
Romantic.
Well, the thing is, it's probably the most romantic film you'll see because it's about this couple, these two 80-year-old people, you know, husband and wife, and she has a series of, you know, physical setbacks and mental setbacks, and he has to take care of her.
Did you see Away From Her by Sarah Polley?
No, I haven't. I want to see
similar, incredible movie. I think, and they're sort of in a genre of their own. Amour goes into this genre. They're sort of deconstruction plots where, you know, tragedies where we're trying to find some hope in the tragedy, and it's like a great life lesson, but it is not a popcorn movie.
Well, no, and that's, I think the hope in it is the fact that this elderly man just keeps moving forward to help his wife. Mm. And you never get that kind of... You never get that kind of story from the typical, you know, Hollywood romance. And there's nothing wrong with a typical Hollywood romance. All these films have their place. Yeah. It's just that this one was incredibly refreshing to see. And I definitely think he deserves it. And in fact, I would say, you know, everything he's been nominated for, he should get.
Wow. Mm. Would you like to work with him as well?
Hell yes. Okay. I'll learn German and French.
All right. So then I'm just going to jump in and I'm going to just quickly sum up. I think that best original screenplay should go to either Django or Moonrise Kingdom. They are the most original voices. They are stories that are the most original we've never seen. I think, you know, awards and writing should go to originality. Originality. I don't care about structure. I don't care about form. I care about original storytelling. Mm-hmm. And Django Unchained was outrageous and wonderful, as Tarantino brings us. And Moonrise Kingdom was original and sweet and quirky in the way only Wes Anderson can do it.
You guys, that was very erudite, very learned, and I learned a lot. I really did. But I'd like to talk about a script starring a lovable, fat, irresponsible drunk from Massachusetts named Ted.
It's not on our list.
And I'm not talking about one of the Kennedys.
Okay.
I'm talking about...
I
worked on that joke for a couple
Dead
hours.
Dead Kennedy joke.
That was a Kennedy joke.
Edward Kennedy.
Yeah, I didn't see Ted on this list. That was an original screenplay by Seth MacFarlane. Now,
hey, the man.
Now, Seth MacFarlane wrote it. I believe he had a hand in producing it.
Yeah.
He did...
He directed it,
he directed it, and yeah. he did
the
voice of Ted. Titanic work. I think that that script for a comedy, such as it was a great comedy. It was superbly written. Small cast, and it was better than it had to be. The whole Giovanni Ribisi character, coming in the beginning, introducing him in the beginning, and then coming back toward the end as even darker, taking him down darker levels, literally going into the basement of an old house in Dorchester.
Wow.
I thought it was fantastic.
There's imagery in Ted. Is that what you're saying? Metaphors in Ted? I love Ted, you're seriously saying Ted deserves a place next to Amour?
Okay, I have, no, listen, I
Ted deserves a place next to the Bin Laden movie?
You've just entered the snub zone.
Okay.
So that's...
Well, I mean, we could probably get
on your soapbox. Tell us tell us how you really feel.
Okay, here's how I really feel. Ted is one of the highest grossing comedies of all time. If you take in the fact that it's almost at 520 million right now, it's only been out for 7 months. It's only behind The Hangover, right? Which is an ensemble comedy.
Right.
You know, Ted is going up against fierce competition. It had, and also domestically, it's only at about 40%, 60% worldwide.
I'm not impressed by numbers. Talk to me about writing.
All right, great. I'm saying the public was into this R-rated non-sequel comedy.
There were
really
jokes
into
in here
it.
That I laughed out loud.
This proves adults
want
to go to the theater and laugh their ass off.
Yeah.
The premise is a wild, imaginative premise. Not to beat on Wes Anderson and Roman Coppola anymore. But you want to talk about an imaginative premise. A teddy bear comes to life when the kid in the mid-80s, when the kid is 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a few years, as it opens up, no one gives a crap.
Yeah.
Great. They let like Hot Tub Time Machine. They got me into the script without having to work too hard for it.
Are you saying Hot Tub Time Machine should be nominated also?
Hot Tub Time Machine.
Wait, because I can get on board for Hot Tub.
Most conversations.
I think I could get on Hot Board.
I can bring just about everything back to Hot Tub Time Machine.
Okay. Anything else? Okay, yeah. So you guys, any more protests? Any more comments about the Oscars this year in general? What about Seth MacFarlane hosting?
I think it's really great. I just hope...
Finally, a real comedian.
Finally. Yeah, it's awesome that he's doing it, but I hope this doesn't mean they're going to shunt him.
Well, he can't do his R-rated jokes, but he has great timing. He's a great performer.
Yeah.
Like, he will not let the joke suck. Every B joke that they hand him to do for the Oscars, he will reject and come up with some cutaway to Stewie.
It's impossible for him to be not... He has to be playing. There's no other way.
The
roast that he hosted.
One will get you one that he does a Stewie impression.
Let's wrap, you guys.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Fine.
Yeah. Ted was awesome.
Okay. Well done.
Well done.
That was great.
The Script is a monthly podcast brought to you by the NYC Screenwriters Collective. Produced and edited by Tawny Foskett. Recorded by Justin D'Ambrosio.
This is The Script, the official podcast of the NYC Screenwriters Collective, a not-for-profit screenwriting workshop dedicated to teaching the craft of writing for film and television. We are a community of beginner, advanced, and working screenwriters engaged in a specialized script development process to improve our members' scripts and help them break into the business. The Script Podcast is the best parts of our workshop, our best script doctors, our hottest screenplays, and our best discussions on the screenwriting craft and current events in film and television. If you live in New York City, sign up for our workshops at meetup.com under NYC Screenwriters Collective. Join our Facebook page, follow our Twitter at scriptfeed, or you can email us at scriptfeed@gmail.com.